You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Now, Stephen Johnson needs very little introduction, but I'm going to give him a really long one anyway. He is the best-selling author of 10 books, including How We Got to Now, Where Good Ideas Come From, and Everything Bad Is Good For You. He writes for Time, Wired, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and he's the host and co-creator of the Emmy-nominated PBS and BBC Two TV series, How We Got to Now. I'm truly delighted and honoured to be introducing Stephen, who has long been one of my favourite writers. I read just about everything that he publishes, and I'm sure many of you do too. And there's lots to read. We're just talking about this, but speaking as somebody who is currently struggling to conceive of an idea for a new book, I'm frankly appalled by Stephen's fecundity. His ten books are all of a very high standard, and they all read beautifully. He's an elegant and skillful writer, so good at what he does that you barely notice the superb technique because you're just enjoying yourself. Stephen is known primarily as a technology and science writer with a particular interest in innovation and creativity. And his knowledge of those fields is deep. But what makes him stand out from his peers is the way he combines this erudition with the ability to make audacious and unexpected connections between different domains, drawing from both the arts and the humanities, a quality which, as he showed us in his book, Where Good Ideas Come From, is central to innovation itself. What I love most about Stephen's work is its immersion in history, the history of technology, but also the deep history of evolution and the history of ideas, literature, cities, and innovation. Enlightenment-era London, in particular, is a deep well of inspiration for him, which is why it's so great to be introducing him here at the RSA to talk about his fascinating new book, Wonderland. So without further ado, please give a very big hand to our guest speaker, Stephen Johnson.
That was a great introduction, Ian. Do you want to keep talking? I really enjoyed that. I was so flattered. Ian is also a fantastic author. We may talk a little bit about his work as well. I'm delighted to be here. This is, I believe, my second visit to the RSA. I have written about the RSA on a couple of occasions. And it occurred to me this morning that, in fact, there was an opportunity to weave together the argument of Wonderland about the importance of play and delight and leisure in driving historical change. There was an opportunity to weave together a story actually from an earlier book of mine called Future Perfect that was kind of fitting for this environment. And it starts really in a, like so many stories about the history of London, it starts with coffee. In the mid to late 1600s, coffee arrives in London, and almost immediately the city goes insane for this new beverage, despite the fact that every account of it describes how awful tasting it was. People really didn't figure out how to make coffee appetizing for about 250 years, apparently. But we put up with it nonetheless because it was so stimulating on multiple levels. And so coffee houses begin to explode across the city of London. In fact, London has much higher density of coffee houses than any other city in Europe by 1700. And all of a sudden, all these people are spending long periods of time frittering away their day drinking coffee with their friends, men only, I should point out. The coffee houses were male only for a very long time. And this becomes such a noticeable pattern that Charles II actually issues a decree banning coffee houses from London because, one, he believes that there are kind of seditious conversation is happening in these coffee houses, which he might have been right about. But he also believes that basically they're a great waste of time. He has this line where he says that people are being distracted from their lawful calling and affairs. And so he issues this decree, bans coffee houses from London, and that ban lasts for 1 week. because people are like, we're not going to give up our coffee. And so the coffeehouse culture continues to explode. And what happens, in fact, over the next 100 years or so, is that Charles II is exactly proved wrong. And in fact, what had seemed like a diversion, what had seemed like a kind of an amusement or excessive leisure, actually turned out to be exceptionally productive. And the entire kind of flowering of the British Enlightenment really was based in the coffeehouse culture of that period. So almost every important idea in science, in business, in politics has some roots in a coffeehouse during that next century. So as most of you probably know, the magazine business originates in coffeehouse culture. Lloyd's of London was famously Lloyd's Coffeehouse. And in 1754, I think it is, a group of guys get together in a coffeehouse in Covent Garden and start talking about how they can encourage certain advances and innovations that British society could find useful. And that coffeehouse meeting is the birth of the RSA. So this very institution actually starts in a coffeehouse as well. And interestingly, given the themes of Wonderland about the importance of delight and amusement in our history, what they originally decide to support in forming the RSA with these premiums where they create these prizes to encourage the cultivation of breakthrough ideas or innovations, the first two prizes they offer are for colors, basically, for dyes that could be used for blue ceramics and red dyes based on the madder plant, which up until that point were largely limited to the Low Countries. So if you wanted to dye a garment turkey red, which was the very popular color at the time, you had to ship it out to Flanders and then bring it back. And so they wanted to encourage, in terms of agriculture, the development of this plant. So they created a prize, basically a reward for anyone who planted madder out there so that we would have red dye inside the British Isles. And so right there you see the beginning of an institution kind of supported by this seemingly kind of idle pursuit of drinking coffee with a bunch of mates at a coffee house, expending energy and money to try and cultivate a color, something not particularly functional. There wasn't really, you know, anything utilitarian about their color red. It was just delightful to look at. And that story, that interest and ingenuity directed towards things that are initially amusing or playful or delightful, that story repeats itself throughout human history. And this is really what I've tried to do in Wonderland is to make the argument that one of the prime movers of historical change is, in fact, that appetite for delight and for play and for amusement. If you think about the kind of model of historical change that most of us learned when we were in grade school or college, you know, what are the prime movers that really drive history? You think about nationalism, you think about religious identity, you think about the quest for power, you think about scientific advances and the like. But I think there is also an argument that alongside those other prime movers, there is this very human desire for delight and for play, and that often those initial explorations, seemingly frivolous, will lead to much more momentous changes down the line, like the institution we're sitting in today. So I want to tell you just a couple of examples to give you a sense of how that argument works from the book, and then Ian will come back and we'll have a conversation and open it up a little bit more. But I want to start with another London story from right around that same period, in the 1680s or so. A new kind of store appears in the streets of a few well-to-do neighborhoods of London. And this was a store that was unusually lavish in its decor. So you would have these beautiful, kind of almost like the drawing room of an aristocratic home, beautiful curtains and gold-plated fireplaces and big glass windows and just all the kind of trappings and decorations of a lovely home. And in these new stores, people would go to buy fabrics or garments or furniture. And up until that point, the experience of shopping had been a much more kind of streamlined affair. You would go, there would be stalls in a big open market or the kind of beginning first arcades, which were interesting spaces, but each individual kind of seller of goods was in a very kind of bare bones environment. And suddenly you had these very posh environments where people would go shopping. And this development mystified a lot of people at the time, particularly men observing this, where they would say, well, wait, what is going on? Why are these shopkeepers wasting so much money making their store look so nice when they should just be selling their goods at the, you know, kind of the, at the lowest price possible, spending the least amount of money as possible on their store so they can maximize their profits? Daniel Defoe has a great description of this where he's just baffled by these stores. He thinks maybe they're going to all this trouble of decorating their store so that they will create the illusion that they have a lot of goods on display. But in fact, or that they have a big inventory. But in fact, we see it now with modern eyes, and we say, of course, what is happening there is the birth of shopping itself as a leisure pursuit, turning the experience of shopping into something that was fun in and of itself, whether you actually bought anything. So creating, in a sense, this wonderland of the store, this envelope of luxury that you got immersed in as you shopped was an important part of the experience, but it was a novel part of the experience as well. And this ended up being a transformative development because what was being shared and showcased in those new stores was increasingly this exotic new fabric from India, calico and chintz, also characterized by incredibly beautiful colors, by vibrant reds and blues that the RSA would later try and cultivate. And it was also, of course, cotton. Right, this was the big breakthrough because up until that point, you could wear cotton as underwear, which was a big breakthrough because up until that point, people would wear wool underwear, which those of you who imagine London in a rainy winter with wool underwear, not so appetizing. So suddenly these beautiful, vibrant patterns from India with the soft, kind of sensual texture of cotton becomes the craze among well-to-do people in London in the late 1600s. And of course, this leads, as most school kids will tell you, to the East India Company making these vast profits. It leads to a great trade imbalance between India and England. But it also leads to a backlash from the traditional wool industries in northern England, who suddenly are seeing their profits devastated by this new interest in this overseas fabric. And what ends up happening is this massive backlash against these women, kind of a misogynist backlash where they're being derided for their sensual interest in this foreign fabric, which is destroying the British economy. And what erupts is really what we would call today a kind of make England's wool industry great again movement, to use, I don't know where that phrase came from. And a whole number of angry pamphlets and plays and poems and songs are written about these women. They're derided as calico madams. And basically, there's something kind of sexualized about their interest in selling out the English economy for this exotic fabric. And in fact, just as in the case of the coffee house, for a while, calico and chintz are actually banned on British shores. But at the same time, another group of inventors and entrepreneurs start to think, well, wait, this would be interesting. What if we could take some of this interesting new steam-powered technology that we have and create automated looms that could produce some of these textiles ourselves here on British soil? And that, as you all know, is the birth of the Industrial Revolution. So if we're asking ourselves, where did the Industrial Revolution come from? What were the prime forces that set it in motion? The traditional way we tell that story is that, well, there were these extraordinary inventors and entrepreneurs who came up with these technologies and invented a factory system, and that eventually led to the creation of an upper middle class, was wealthy enough to create a consumer society in the 19th century that would go to department stores and things like that. But in fact, the creation of that technology actually starts with that moment of delight, that in a sense kind of consumer moment, looking at a fabric, feeling, touching a fabric, and then eventually triggers all the changes that lead to industrialization. And if we only tell the story from the point of view of the big inventions and neglect that other side of the story, that playful side of the story, we are missing an important part of understanding what brought it about in the first place. Now, it's important to mention here, while this argument and the book itself is in many ways a celebration of this history and making the argument that our appetite for fun and delight is an important part of who we are, it is not always a happy story, right? Cotton is maybe the most extreme example of this. When you think of certainly the condition of industrial labor for the next 150 years or so at least, and most importantly, I would say, in the case of the United States, the appetite for cotton ends up creating and really sustaining the American system of slavery. And there's a significant argument that I think a lot of historians would agree that slavery probably would have withered away in the United States much earlier than it did had the southern states not gotten dependent on cotton as a cash crop. And it was their dependence on the slave system in creating cotton that enabled or kind of sustained slavery into the 1850s. And had cotton not arrived, we probably would have not had a civil war, for instance, in the United States, and slavery would have ended much earlier. So there is definitely an argument to be made that cotton was, for at least 200 years, the worst thing that had happened to the world. And certainly those late, you know, 1680s, 1690s London fashionable elite who were enjoying this new fabric had no idea they were about to set in motion those kinds of events with that, you know, kind of extent of human suffering. But that, too, is part of the impact. And another recurring theme, which you can see in the story of cotton and calico, is the importance of play and delight in the history of globalization. So oftentimes when we're seeking out a new experience, when we're trying to be surprised by something, we want to have an experience that we've never had before that's delightful, what that does is literally cause us to explore, to encounter new cultures, just as encountering the patterns and dyeing techniques of calico and chintz brought us to India and brought those fabrics back to England. And so again and again, you'll see in the story of play that really the idea of global markets, the idea of globalization has been driven from the origins of, say, the spice trade on by our interest in delight and in wonder. And maybe my favorite example of this, which the book actually starts with, is an institution in Baghdad at the height of the Islamic Golden Age. There was an institution, in some ways not unlike the RSA, called the House of Wisdom. That's about 800 AD. And the House of Wisdom was, in modern terminology, in a sense, a kind of a mix between a think tank, a translation bureau, and a maker lab. There were a lot of engineers working inside of the House of Wisdom. And they produced some really cutting-edge engineering work, and they collected a lot of the schematics and designs for those projects in a series of books that also had great names, like The Book of Ingenious Devices. And we've reproduced some of them in the book. They're lovely. And they contain, in these schematics, some engineering ideas that were 500, 600 years ahead of anything that was going on in the West, for instance. They're kind of breakthrough ideas in hydraulics and float valves and in clock making. There are more accurate clocks than the West would see for another 600 to 700 years that these Baghdad engineers were working on. But what's so interesting about this book, if you look at it, is almost every contraption that they diagram all the way through, if you flip through all the pages, they're all toys. They're all little automatons. They're little playthings. There's an elephant clock. There's a little automated peacock that if you pull its feathers, it delivers a little bit of soap to you. Or there are lots of little miniaturized automated musical instrument players all the way through it. So what you have is this very interesting kind of collision between what seem to be two different worlds, incredibly advanced engineering and child's play. And they're wedded together in all these devices. But perhaps the most important invention that came out of this culture, created by a group of brothers named the Banu Musa, was a device that wasn't in any of these more famous books. It was actually in a separate manuscript that was almost lost to history until it was discovered about 100 years ago. And in this separate manuscript, they describe a device that they called the instrument that plays itself. This is a recreation of the instrument that they did in Germany a couple of years ago. And the instrument was effectively a kind of an automated organ, although it was actually designed to work with an automated flute player. So behind the scenes, it was an organ, but there was a kind of a robot that looked like it was playing the flute. And music would come out of it. You could play songs, and it was kind of this nice little illusion and trick of the eye. But what made this technology so radical at the time was that the notes were triggered by a rotating cylinder, like a music box, something called a pin cylinder, where the pins on the cylinder correspond to the notes you want the instrument to play and the length of the note you want it to play. And the Banu Musa had designed this specifically, and they spent a lot of their kind of description in this text talking about this feature, so that if you wanted it to play a different song, you could take out the cylinder, code a new one with new information, cut. They would actually use this language of cutting a new cylinder, like the language we would later use for cutting a record. And then you'd put that new cylinder in, and it would play a completely different song. And this meant that this device was really the first programmable machine. It was the first machine that was designed specifically to be open-ended in its instructions. It could do one thing, but if you wanted to do something else, you created a different set of codes, and you inserted it, and it would behave in a different way. And so, in a sense, the whole idea of the distinction between hardware and software becomes kind of imaginable at this point in time with this invention. And in fact, that idea, programmability, which is, of course, one of the most important ideas of modern life, stays alive, is kept alive, through music for hundreds of years, through music boxes, basically, until people start to think about programmable automatons themselves. In the 1700s, people like Jacques de Vaucanson, the great French inventor in the middle of the 1700s, who starts tinkering with actually also automated flute players and other devices controlled by rotating pin cylinders that can be swappable if you want to program different behavior. Vaucanson is probably most famous for this creation, the digesting duck, which was a mechanical, very lifelike duck. It was so lifelike that you could feed it food and it would actually process the food and expel it there at the backside of the duck there. You see the arrow. It was also known as the defecating duck. And people would hang around in the kind of salons in Paris looking at these mechanical defecating ducks with wonder and delight. That's what the cool kids were doing in Paris in the 1740s. So Vaucanson was building all these kind of contraptions, and at some point he began to think, well, wait a second, if we can create encoded information to control automated music and automated simulated life forms, not to mention digestion, would it be interesting if we started to think about using these same technologies to create an automated loom and to create a loom that we could program to determine what fabric it would weave? And that led him to create a kind of series of prototypes of automated looms programmed by these big metallic pin cylinders, just like the instrument that plays itself. But it didn't work very well because the patterns, by definition, had to be very repetitive, because the cylinder, every time it rotated, you would have the same pattern again. And they were very expensive to produce if you wanted to change the pattern. And so the idea kind of languished until about 50 years later, directly influenced by Vaucanson. Another legendary French inventor, Jacquard, came up with the idea for a programmable loom that would get its instructions from the code cut into paper punched cards, not metallic cylinders. And that became the Jacquard loom, which was a revolutionary idea in terms of textile technology at the time and changed the world of textile production, but also influenced directly Charles Babbage here back in London, who used paper punch cards to create the first true programmable computers, the analytical engine and the difference engine, in the 1830s and the 1840s, directly influenced by Jacquard. And in fact, paper punch cards, those of you who are old enough as I am to remember, continued on to be a part of modern computers into the 70s. I remember the big computer we got at my grade school in like 1975 used punch cards. So ask yourself the question, just as in the question of where the Industrial Revolution came from, where did the modern computer come from? The traditional way we answer that question is we say, well, it came out of military technology, it came out of cracking the Enigma code, it came out of calculating rocket trajectories, all of which is true. That is an essential part of the story, and we should celebrate that. But it also came out of an automated flute player and people dreaming up new ways to create interesting robotic toys that would delight people in salons, and the pursuit of interesting fabrics that could be woven in a more automated way. Those, too, are important parts of the story. And if we only tell the kind of the big military story, we miss the whole picture. A lot of what we've talked about and a lot of what we conventionally talk about when we think about innovation focuses, understandably, on gadgets, on objects, on actual technology. But sometimes some of the most important ideas actually come out of less technological machines. The ideas that end up really changing society are sometimes just ideas, or they're spaces, or they're ways of thinking about physical space that are new that end up changing the world. And the coffee house, for instance, is a great example of this. Creating a space devoted to leisure, devoted to a kind of middle ground between work and home, where people were free to have open-ended conversations, creating that fluidity of idea exchange, that itself was a great innovation. It didn't really involve a lot of technology. It involved an interesting new taste and drug from across the world, so it was a story of globalization as well. But it wasn't about a machine, and yet it clearly changed the world. And we see this again and again and again, where we create these spaces that are themselves kind of mini wonderlands, where we're free to explore and experience the world in a new way. In fact, there's a important transformation that I talk about a little bit in the book about the transformation of nature in creating natural spaces and turning them into kind of wonderlands. Up until the 1800s, a lot of European city dwellers considered nature to be, you know, physically abhorrent. That when you would go out into the wilderness, this was a terrifying experience. And that they fought so hard to kind of create these cities where they would be safe. And if you were in nature, it was something that, you know, it was really repulsive. In fact, mountains were widely considered to be just hideous, abominations. People taking carriage rides near the Alps would actually ask to have their eyes blindfolded so as not to see these deformities off in the distance. And that, too, started to change, thanks in part to the Romantics and other scientists who started to celebrate the art of mountaineering and things like that. And in the middle of the 19th century, nature suddenly becomes a much more celebrated thing. Nature becomes a space to be enjoyed and to be savored and to amuse oneself in. In fact, there, I'll skip ahead this quickly. There's a great device that people used to use called the clawed glass. That started up in the 1800s, where people would go to enjoy nature, and they would show up at their waterfall or with a view of the Matterhorn or whatever it is, and they would take this little mirror, which was a mirror that had little kind of etches in it, little cracks, and they would get in front of the beautiful natural object they were looking at, and they would turn around and look at it through the mirror, and what the effect was, because of the little etchings in the glass, the effect was it made it look like an oil painting of the thing itself. And so they would turn it into this aesthetic experience. It was effectively an Instagram filter before we had that. But that was suddenly nature was something to be enjoyed and to be savored in that same way. And it became a space of wonder and delight as well. And that led to the creation of the National Parks Movement and to a lot of the modern environmental movement. So that, too, was important. But I'll just end with another play space even older than the coffee house, which is the tavern, the bar, the pub. Maybe the first space devoted exclusively to an escape from the normal world, escape from home, escape from church, escape from the workplace, a space where you would go, spend some time with some friends, have a little alcohol, and the whole entire environment was devoted to that experience. The history of taverns and pubs, you know, in England, I probably don't need to stress this too much, but the history of these spaces has been incredibly important, particularly for the history of politics. Very often, new social relationships, new ways of interacting, new ways of being public in society first take root in these wonderland spaces of bars and pubs. Just think in modern life about the importance of bars to the history of the gay rights movement, from Stonewall Tavern and the Black Cat, where a lot of these early protests happened in the United States. Something about a bar creates an environment where people are willing to experiment with new identities that they're not necessarily willing to present in a wider public context. And so new ways of interacting with other human beings become possible in these spaces once they've been carved out and defined. And of course, in the American system, you cannot tell the story of the American Revolution without talking about the network of taverns, particularly in New England. that just as the coffee house was central to the British Enlightenment, the tavern was central to the American Revolution. It was the hub where all these ideas of rebellion really first took root. It was an important communications network. It was where the Declaration of Independence was read aloud. It was where texts like Common Sense were read aloud. It is possible, it's probably likely, that the American Revolution would have happened had taverns never been invented. I don't want to overstate the point here. But it is almost, by definition, true that for the revolution to have happened without taverns, another mechanism for social gathering and for the sharing of ideas would have had to have been invented. It would have required a different information network, a different social network to be created. And so you have momentous political changes coming out of spaces that look like, in Charles II's words, a space to escape your lawful calling and affairs, but they actually end up changing the affairs of the world. And I'll just say, just to kind of bring it full circle, when the British soldiers arrived to put down this, unsuccessfully put down this rebellion, the red coats they were famously wearing were dyed red with the madder plant that had been grown successfully on British soils, because right at 1775, right as the rebellion was starting, the RSA had concluded that its premium that it had announced to support the indigenous growth of madder was successful. And there was enough red dye in the British colonies, I mean, in actual shore within the shores of England itself, that they no longer needed to artificially encourage its growth. And so their red coats were actually dyed with locally grown red dye, thanks to the coffee house interventions of the RSA. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Some of us still feel that way about nature, by the way.
So it's okay.
I never leave the city unless I have to. Thank you very much. That's fascinating. I'd just be interested to hear you talk a little bit about the genesis of the idea and at which point you thought, this is a book.
I was very confident that it was a book all along. This came directly out of how we got to now. Those of you who read that book or saw the show, it was a book in a series about six innovations that had changed the world. And a lot of it was devoted to similar unlikely, unintended consequences, like you've seen in some of the stories that I just told. So as I was thinking about a kind of follow-up, both book and show, because we're hopeful to make another series based on Wonderland, I thought this format is really great. I like writing in this mode, and you could write 100 books in this mode because there's so many stories you could tell. What I wanted to have, though, was a theme to make book two and potentially series two a little different. And so I thought, well, it'd be interesting. Well, I'll focus on the history of play, the playful things, because so much of the modern world is made up of experiences that are wonderlands of one form or another, and so it would be interesting to know what that history is, and you know, that would be a kind of a selling idea. What I didn't have, though, was this kind of macro argument about the importance of it in the non-playful world, and I didn't feel that I needed that. I felt it was just the history of play was interesting in and of itself, but the more I dove into these stories, and it really was a culmination of kind of research and ideas that I've been working on for 20 or 30 years. It would have been much harder to write this book when I was 30. I feel like this was the first book I wrote where I was like, oh, I really needed to be 47 to write this, because I've been collecting these stories over the years. But when I finally kind of sat down to write it, when I started really going through the research, I began to realize that every thread that I followed ended up leading to some important idea in science or some important idea in politics, and so that the argument could actually be much stronger. So I knew it was always going to be a fun book. I just didn't know that it was going to have a kind of a theory of world history behind it when I got there.
I love that. It's fantastic. One of the fascinating distinctions you make in the book is between different types of pleasure, and you identify why play and delight in particular is connected to innovation. Could you talk about that?
There's a very interesting close relationship between play and delight, and and curiosity, which you've written. Ian has a tremendous book called Curious that's related to all these themes. I mean, you see people kind of pursuing things and getting fascinated with things just for the sheer intrigue of it without necessarily a sense of where it's going to lead. And that exploratory kind of mode is a very powerful one. When you're kind of self-motivated, you have to know more, you have to explore this particular problem more, whatever it is. In the case of play, this is one of the things that I wrestled with. I was like, why? It's understandable that people got into these things. It's understandable why people were delighted by fabrics or by musical instruments or these other things. What's harder to explain is why they were such drivers of innovation in kind of the straight world, too, as well as in the playful world. And I eventually began to realize that what a lot of these things have in common is that they're surprising. That they, when you first encounter a new musical instrument, when you play a game, for instance, we haven't really talked about games, but there's a whole chapter on games. What makes a game fun is that every time you play it, it's a little different. A game that is repetitive is not fun. Songs that are too repetitive, too predictable, are not fun. What seems to kind of excite the mind is the zone of kind of controlled surprise. Too much surprise and it's excessive, too little surprise and it's boring. But when we put ourselves in an environment where you have a bit of surprise, that we lean forward, we pay attention, we're interested in that. And I think that when you look at it that way, it helps explain why so much innovation comes out of this, because the goalposts of surprise are constantly moving, right? The thing that surprised and delighted your parents, you are born into a world where that thing is ubiquitous, and so it's not surprising and interesting to you. And so if we're going to keep people surprised, we have to keep kind of pushing the boundaries and come up with new things to surprise them. And just look at, in the chapter on music, just the sheer number of musical instruments that we've invented, and now we're inventing whole new timbres electronically. We're constantly expanding. If we weren't interested in this ever-shifting level of surprise, we would be happy. We'd be happy with just the same set of instruments that we had 200 years ago.
Whereas certain other pleasures are connected more to the business of staying alive, right?
So, right.
And then the more inward kind of...
It's a difference between, and I tried to set this up very clearly at the beginning of the book, which is to say this is not a book about biologically driven pleasures. Mm. So there's not a chapter on sex. I'm sorry to tell you that. And if you think about the pleasures of, the opiates or something like that, or the pleasures of sugar, right? There's a deep-seated biological reason why we have a taste for those things. Now, we do come up with ever more elaborate ways to provide those pleasures, whether it's a big gulp or heroin.
Yeah.
But they're rooted in our biology, and they don't have that kind of expansive border that delight does, that surprise does. And so it's what I love about the history of delight and play is that it's one of these cases where the traditional battle between nature and nurture, between genes and culture, gets beautifully complicated, because we have a genetic biological urge to be interested in surprising things, but that urge compels us to invent new things and create new culture and expand, in a sense, what it means to be human or the possible ways of being amused or entertained in the world. And so it's something that comes from our nature that forces us to invent new culture, which I think is kind of nice.
Beautiful sort of feedback loop, isn't it? Okay. Would anyone like to ask the first question?
Just thinking about the word play itself, and I can sort of think about two ways in which it might be used. One, say playing a game, which is within a set of rules or a framework that somebody else has set up, say a game of football or maybe a computer game, and then how that might be different from, say, play, which may result in redefining the framework or redefining the culture or recreating the future. Do you have any comments on that, the two types of ways of thinking of the word play?
Yeah, that's a very articulate way of describing those different tensions. First off, I would say I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what the umbrella term should be here, because we think about play in kind of a game-like sense, as different from the play, say, of fashion. And in a sense, what this book is about is a mix of kind of play, delight, and wonder kind of under one umbrella. And I think it's useful to put those things under that one umbrella, because when you see them all together, you realize how powerful they are. In some ways, I'm stealing from a framework that Brian Eno came up with. He gave a great lecture in the Peel lecture series a couple years ago, where he was talking about this, his definition of art. And his definition of art is all the things we don't have to do. You know, we have to get food, we have to keep ourselves warm, you know, we have to reproduce if we want to have children, we have to do these things. We don't have to, you know, wear calico or play video games, right? Those are things we choose to do. And so if you look at the world of things that we choose to do for no strict utilitarian reason, that world is very influential. And so that's a definition of play. But the difference between play working within rules versus the play of making up rules is a very profound idea. And I talk about it a little bit in the book, but I've been thinking about it a little bit more because Stuart Brand said to me, the great American writer, said, we were talking about this, and he said, you know, the thing about when you look at young kids at play, when they're younger, when they haven't been kind of institutionalized into official sport, you know, and they're playing Little League baseball or they're playing football, whatever, one of the defining things about children at play is that part of the play is making up the rules of the game. So you sit there with, you know, when you're 6 years old and you're in your backyard and you've got a ball and you're like, okay, the rule is you have to hit the wall 3 times and then you catch it and then the next person who catches it gets, you know, and you invent the rules and that's part of it. And then eventually you get older and they're like, these are the rules, they cannot be changed. And I think getting back to that sense of inventing the rules as part of play is an important thing to do. So I wrote a piece about this if you're interested. I had this beautiful experience with my then 9-year-old son last summer where we spent, as a kind of summer-long project, we designed a board game, the two of us. And designing a board game is a great, I mean, it should be a part of school curricula. It is in some cases. It's an amazing kind of conceptual exercise and incredibly fun. Because you have to sit there and think, well, what should the theme of the game be? What should the rules of the game be? What kind of chance element should we introduce to the game? And when you're designing it and you're kind of making the board up and figuring out the elements, you're making this prediction in your head about when all these forces interact, you know, this is what's going to work and this is why it's going to be fun and this is the strategy that you're going to have. And then you finally play it and it's terrible. You know, because it ends after 3 rolls of the dice, or somebody always wins if they go first, or whatever it is, so you can't predict in advance. And so you revise the game based on that feedback, and you iterate, and then you come up with a new version, and you play that. And it's really the scientific method, or it's product design. And yet, it's a very high-level kind of thinking for a 9-year-old to be doing, but the 9-year-old has no idea that it's a high-level thinking because they're just having so much fun with dad. So I encourage you to design your own board games with your kids. That's the one takeaway.
Thanks, Stephen, for, you know, I'm blowing my mind a bit.
Oh, good.
So I work for the charity London Play, and we're in the business of innovative interventions in London to make sure that play is accessible for all children. Great. One of the things we're constantly having to do is restate the argument of why play is important and beneficial and part of what we need to do if we're going to have a future generation of Londoners that are fit for purpose, really. Why do you think that play is not on the same level of importance as formal education, particularly if there's anyone from government in terms of funding?
Right, right. Okay. We'll take one more.
Thanks. I just wanted to talk about gender, and at the moment, mostly what we've been talking about are very male spaces and the very presence of men in those spaces precludes small children as well as women. I think as we move forward, it's really important that we make sure that the whole realm of innovation and exploration is seen as important for all children who become all adults. And I am very concerned that even in the 21st century, we have toy shops with gendered sections, which still limit girls' play to a very gendered model of femininity.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you had any comment about that.
Great, great observation. Okay, so let me answer both those points quickly. In terms of understanding, people recognize the importance of play. The reason why people underestimate it, I think, that is relatively easy to understand in the sense that it's, you know, that's just the connotations of the word, right? And we have we've had 200 years of a kind of educational system that is, you know, it's back to grad grind in Dickens, right? That it's kind of like, no, this is, we go to school and you must learn and you must memorize these multiplication tables, and play is this thing we're trying to get rid of. But it's changing. I mean, and your organization sounds like it's on the cutting edge of this, and people are starting to realize. And there's one of the things that's not in the book, but that I've explored a little bit. We have a podcast that kind of accompanied the book, and I talked to some people about this. I was talking to Allison Gopnik, the great Berkeley developmental psychologist. If you look at other animals that also, a lot of mammals show play behavior in early their childhood. There seems to be a kind of a direct correlation between the length and extent of childhood play and the ultimate kind of adaptive, flexible intelligence of that organism. And in fact, it turns out the famous fox and hedgehog opposition from Singer that other people have expanded on, where the fox knows many little things, but the hedgehog knows only one big thing. The hedgehog, whatever the stimulus, the hedgehog has one defense, which is to curl up into a ball and hope that nothing happens. And the fox is very clever and can do all these things. Turns out, everybody's been talking about that philosophically for years, but the difference, she went and actually looked at the developmental cycle of foxes and actual hedgehogs, and one of the defining things is that foxes play a lot. So the parent fox will bring back a little dead mouse and will kind of throw it in with the baby foxes, and they'll literally play like a game of football with this thing, kind of playing around, and they have a much longer kind of play period, and they end up being, you know, much more open-ended in their intelligence. And I think the idea is that play is a great, if you're trying to train a mind for a world where there are predictable rules and responses and you just need to memorize those rules and responses, play isn't all that useful. But if you're trying to train a mind for a world where the environment is constantly changing and it's unpredictable and you're going to have to dream up new strategies on the fly, then play is a fantastic way to educate that person. Gender, or that fox. gender, it's a really interesting question. I mean, there's a prominent role, it's a complicated role, of women in Wonderland, for instance, in the Calico and Chintz story. And part of what I'm trying to say is that choices and decisions that women were making back then, even at a point where they were, you know, had far less potential power and status in society, were still shaping the course of history. Now, granted, it was in a kind of fashion and consumption sense, so on some level it's also playing to existing stereotypes that we'd want to get around. But I think that involvement is there, and it shows up in a couple of different ways. It's very interesting with games today, right, where there is this big divide between electronic games. There are a lot of women playing electronic games, more than we would think. But in terms of the really... there's kind of gender parity with games if you include kind of smartphone games and kind of those kinds of games. But in terms of traditional video games, it's really dominated by boys. And why that is a really interesting thing. I think a large part has to do with the fact that they're designed by boys or grown-up boys. And games that have been able to kind of break out from that and have more of a girl audience or a female audience have been really encouraging. We need to encourage more of that because there's a lot to be, I think, gotten out of the gameplay. But I agree. I'm writing now a book about decision making, and how to make better complex decisions and group decisions. And one of the major things that we come back to again and again and again, if you look at group decisions, is gender diversity. Is a huge factor in driving better decision-making in groups. There was just a study recently where there were a number of studies that show this, but there was one that was pretty interesting where they had a group that was all men, and they had them make a couple of complicated decisions, and then they had a group where they introduced half women, and they did that, and they were much better as a group collectively at solving problems, coming up with complex decisions. Then they did it where it was all women, and that actually was the best-performing group. So I don't know... what that means.
Thank you. So all that playing has led to a wonderful world with lots of opportunities, but at the same time there's a lot of dissatisfaction, disenfranchisement with people saying stop playing and let's make America great again, or stop playing and let's build a new caliphate. So on the one hand, we'd love to hear from you why you think that is the case and what drives that, but more importantly, how can playing help in finding a solution for some of that? How could you, for example, build games where people, instead of catching Pokemons, catch ISIS Twitter accounts and report them or so.
My question is about where do you think play is headed, especially given that our work world is becoming more competitive, people work more hours, yeah. People talk about the number of hours that they work more and more often, and I'm just wondering, where do you think the future of play is going?
Okay, first one, a very easy question, why is the modern world happening the way it is now? In politics, I can answer that really quickly. We were going to talk about Trump anyway. Is he still president? I haven't had time to check.
Trump is a great example of something that started out as an entertainment, essentially a toy, and it's become horrifyingly material to history.
Well, there's a whole riff in one of the chapters in the book about illusions. That's a very fun chapter, actually, we didn't really talk about. But it talks about how once you have the optical illusion of motion pictures with synchronized sound and the close-up, that it creates this explosion in celebrity culture that wasn't possible really before. And human beings, for whatever reasons, can't not feel an emotional connection to someone presented to them at a high enough resolution with synchronized sound in a close-up form. We just form these bonds. And so this is like cotton being a downside. Once you have this illusion that takes off, you know, then you have the Kardashians, right? It's one of the offsets of this that is probably more regrettable. And Trump is very much that. I mean, I really think that the fact that he was a reality television star, had he not been a reality television star, he would have not won the election. I don't think he would have even won the nomination. So that is, you know, a side of this, it's pretty grim that there's a kind of, for those of you who know the book, Neil Postman, Amusing Ourselves to Death, kind of side of this where we get sucked into these imaginary relationships with this fictitious people playing themselves on television, and we're like, oh, I like that guy, I'll vote for him for president, and then the next thing you know, we have an authoritarian regime running the United States. But I think there's a lot of interesting work that's being done now on kind of what's called serious games or games for change, and the game as a vehicle for affecting political change is an interesting one. But I would also point to another playful side of life that I don't cover in the book, but I wrote about in The Guardian last week, actually, which is comedy and satire. And I think one of the things that is clear in the last 6 months, at least in the American situation, I don't know if this is true of Brexit, but it's true certainly with Trump, that political comedy and satire has never been so important in the current political conversation. And that's true for a couple of levels. One is, if you think about the Women's March, just think about, it was the funniest protest ever. People had all these incredibly funny signs, and they spent all that time in part on those funny signs because they knew that they would circulate on social media. So you make a great political joke, and it gets out there, and it energizes people, and it creates a kind of bond between people in difficult times, all that stuff. But it's also uniquely powerful right now because Trump himself he's this bizarre mix of kind of quasi-dictator and emotionally needy, person, man-child, who is, this is going out over the internet. I may not.
Tweeting about you. Stephen Johnson is a hater.
Forget what I said.
Yeah.
Fake news.
Failed author Stephen Johnson.
Yeah, exactly. But I think, you know, clearly what Saturday Night Live is doing is really actively getting under his skin and throwing him off in an amazing way. I mean, people have been making fun of the president of Saturday Night Live for 40 years, but it's never had the direct effect on a leader that it clearly has on Trump. So I think that both the role of comedy and just keeping ourselves sane during this period, but also actually making very targeted interventions, it's playing a really important role. Future of play. The two things I would say. One, I mean, there's a lot of beautiful things starting to happen in terms of play, kind of an augmented reality sense of play, turning the real world around us into kind of play spaces. I was just in Bristol yesterday, and they've had some great projects there about kind of playing the city. Pokemon Go was a beautiful example of turning real world spaces into a kind of wonderland, a playground where your kids and your grown ups are out, hunting imaginary Japanese monsters, as you're alluding to. So there's a lot of opportunity to do that. I think that's going to be really fun to see. But I hope that the real future is in the both in the educational context, but also in the work context, right? So how do we create work environments where we recognize the importance of that playful imagination? And there's an old cliche about the kind of the Google campus where you go there and you're like, they have all the foosball tables everywhere. And I've been to Google a lot, and no one ever seems to be playing foosball. They just have them there. I don't know what to think. And sometimes I think people look at that and they say, oh, those are the perks you get when you're an incredibly profitable company. You can kind of afford to give people ping pong tables and pool foosball tables and a volleyball court and all that kind of stuff. But I think it's actually the other way around, that the Silicon Valley culture, the tech culture, starting in the 70s with Atari and then Apple and the companies after that, they came out of the counterculture. They came out of the hippies and the merry pranksters and stuff like that, always had this sense that to be creative and to be innovative, you had to have this sense of delight and wonder and play and curiosity about the world. And so their work environments had that from the beginning. And that's why they became immensely profitable companies. It's not a perk that you get at the end of that. And it doesn't always have to be the obligatory foosball table. I was at Etsy, the great kind of artisanal crafts online store, and they have headquarters in Brooklyn. And their version of that is their offices are filled with musical instruments. And I guess Rob Kineheim, or whatever his name is, that started Etsy, he was a musician. And I guess if you work at Etsy and you live in Brooklyn, by definition, you have an indie band that you're in as well. And so a lot of their employees are musicians. And so because of that kind of cultural history of the organization, they've scattered their offices. There's an acoustic guitar here, there's a grand piano over here, there's a band room where you can go, there's a little recording studio that's soundproof, you can go in and play. And it's a beautiful idea because you're sitting there at work, you're cranking on things, and then you're like, all right, I'm just going to go and like play guitar for a few minutes with some friends and then go back to work. I think that's something really lovely in that.
Sadly, that is the end of our playtime this lunchtime. Back to work this afternoon. Thank you very much for coming along, and thank you everyone online for participating. And finally, thank you very much to our amazing speaker, Stephen Johnson.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.